Good afternoon, Hera. I just wanted to start by asking you to introduce yourself a little bit and tell us who you are and what it is that you do. Welcome, by the way. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you, Renee. Thank you for inviting me. It's also nice to see you and hear you here. I'm currently in Amsterdam. Before I was living in Hong Kong. I'm a curator and a writer. Renee and I, I guess we met in Dakar when I was doing the Raw Academy. I want to say session 7, the Images for Our Times.
Seven,
And
yes.
Renee was a session before. And so we spent a good 2 months together there, and that's how we first met.
Yeah, and we talk a lot about the places that we are. I think these are rarely the same place, but it's really been good to connect with you across like different times and spaces and different situations. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, now you live in Amsterdam, but you're from Hong Kong, among many other places. But I feel like since we've met, you have become somewhat newly diasporic and are thinking more and more about what it might mean to work outside of Hong Kong, to be traveling while thinking about that space and always kind of like throwing back to your communities there. So maybe you can like update us a little bit about what the situation is at home, how that has advised your work and changed the way that you work and that you move, and what communities you're still in touch with there and what their priorities are going forward.
It's funny because it's true. Like we met in Dakar. That was in 2019, in October, November, or so. And I remember it very well because things in Hong Kong had the uprisings in Hong Kong had broken out in June in 2019, and I still came to Dakar later that year. And I think a week after our sessions had begun, we were. Maybe a week after October 17th, which is when the Lebanese Revolution also broke out. And then Rasha Salty and Khalil Jore from Lebanon came to, they still came to Dakar. And we were having this kind of like frenetic conversations there for this week when they were there. And I remember both of them had said, I can't talk about anything else other than this right now.
Yes.
And I felt very much the same way. But, growing up, my parents are from Hong Kong, but I, actually did grow up diasporic. So I was born in the US, and was there as a kid. And then we moved to Toronto. I went to university in Canada. And then only after that did I decide somewhat sporadically to move back or like to move to Hong Kong. I guess like back is not exactly the right word, although my family and I visited Hong Kong every year when I was a kid. I never lived there, so I didn't really have expectations for what it was to be. So it was not necessarily a kind of heritage tour for me or a return home thing. It was rather a kind of interesting place in which I wanted to know more about and was sort of done with Montreal. So then I went. And then since then, I was living and working there. It's kind of the place in which I had to. And did formulate a so-called career, or I became a professional when I was there in ways that were not present nor economically necessary in Montreal. And so I think my sense of place is very much tied up with Hong Kong. When I was there, I, had a job, I had a place to live. Like actually, I imagined living there for the rest of my life. Of course, the events in 2019, the revolution, the Be Water Revolution, changed everything. But with no regrets, I guess, in any way that we had to fully participate in what that was. Well, since then, as you know, and you also did this program, I went to Amsterdam because of the DAPL program in 2020. So this was already after the revolution had been quelled by the outbreak of the pandemic. At the time, there weren't necessarily like strident measures. There were later on like extremely strident measures, but in the beginning, not so much. It was more that I think the Hong Kong people's like memory and fear of a mysterious virus a la SARS was what kept everyone at home. And although organizing and continued and in many ways that didn't involve mobilizations on the street, The government very much took advantage of this time to pass the national security law to change the legislature and everything from the ground up. So all the nitty gritty, you know, who is determining funding, like who is allowed to be a teacher, who is allowed to be a lawyer, you know, what banners are allowed to fly, like what museums are allowed to remain open, all of these things were being enacted on at this time. And every day was like another one of these things. And I think from the outside, it doesn't, these things don't get picked up because they're so minor, and they're so detailed and require so much context. But, you know, when you live there, you start to feel that like everything that is and constitutes Hong Kong is being eradicated. So after the DAPL, you know, so I went to DAPL to sort of take a break. And I, you know, after the program finished, I sort of hung on waiting for quarantine in Hong Kong. But I think that in the time of the program, I sort of realized that although I'm legally allowed to return to Hong Kong, it's not, I don't know if I could emotionally tolerate working there anymore, which I think is actually kind of funny because I, you know, I've done some projects in mainland China, in other countries in which it is objectively worse, you know, in terms of the laws that you have to kind of wiggle your way around or how you deal with censorship or pre-censorship or negotiating with artists or what you can say, but finding ways to say it and really like pushing for a kind of like increased space of autonomy for the arts. And that kind of project of doing that is so important in so many places that we work, you know, around the world. But I think that with the case of Hong Kong, even though a lot of things are still allowed to be said, it's just something about the lack of consent about what is allowed to be said that I find very hard to imagine like throwing all my eggs in the basket and working there full time.
How do you mean, you lack know, of consent? Is that like a consensus around what can be foregrounded versus what can't? Or
I think when I think about consent in relationship to censorship, it's that, for example, you know, I was not living in mainland China, and then if I would do a project there, and I think this is the same for a lot of people who've done projects there, like this just being one example of many places that enact censorship, you know, it could be Vietnam, Thailand, like wherever, is that you go in knowing that these are the rules in which you are playing by. And so you try to push, you try to like push for a bit more here or there, see if this will get past the bureau, see if like, you know, this director would approve that. And then, you know, some things may be removed and things are sort of like also, you know, you're the curator in a situation, but then it's also shaped by this kind of like what you can call it also a curatorial practices of the censorship bureau. You know, like censorship also kind of curates things and kind of produces a certain cultural governmentality. And that there's an acceptance of that because I decided to do a project in mainland China. I will accept the final outcome is still under my name. I will author like that final outcome. But I think in the case with Hong Kong, you know, for us who were living and working there before 2019, it's just that the changes that happened after, we actively fought against that. And because it did not succeed, a lot of those changes were still enacted. It feels very unconsensual. Like you did not agree to this set of rules to be right, like working on the arts with. Yes. And I think that that's the thing that's like hard to negotiate, because I think for a lot of people, you know, for example, we can imagine someone who comes from the outside now, some outside, like anyone who wasn't in Hong Kong in this time period and wants to work there. And there's like all this increased scrutiny over video art, you know, before video art, you didn't need to send it to the censorship bureau and now you do. So in the past, the way it works in Hong Kong is like if you want to do any public screening, but like a film screening, you will like send your films to the censorship bureau and they would give you a rating. So the films are not censored per se. It's called that, but they would just be like, oh, this is category 3. There's like almost pornography in it, you know, or it's like this is like the equivalent of G-rated category 1. And this is, and then you kind of like tape this license, they pop out within 12 or 14 days, like next to your film screening. So this was something when I was working as a curator at Tycoon Contemporary, we did screenings, we would file the films to the censorship bureau. But now the censorship bureau is actually enacting forms of censorship where films would be filed and then they would suggest edits or disclaimers. And also in the past, video art did not have to be filed, like video art in exhibitionary settings, and now it does. So this, like, in a way, like, you can say that compared to a lot of places, this is not a big deal. Like, this is something that already in many countries you already have to do before. But this is just one example. And I think that that's very just hard to accept when you know why they want you to file that, you know, when you can see the beginning of the transformation.
Yeah. And I wonder in that respect, what you think your position is as a curator, as a different type of curator than you've described, right? Because censorship is very much a curatorial project. So how do you think about your role as a curator, as a cultural worker in those kinds of spaces, and whether or not you're able to go back, or whether or not you're ever based there again? Like, you speak to that culture because it is your culture in many respects. So, yeah, how do you situate yourself, and what do you think is the importance of the kind of practices that you are starting to develop now? You spoke earlier about moving from Amsterdam and kind of circling back to working in Asia more consciously, but also being based there. So can you tell us a little bit more about, like, how then you reorient your practice to attend to the pressures of Hong Kong, but then also the areas close by?
I think in a way, like during 2019, a question that everybody had for themselves, cultural workers included, but not exclusively, was, you know, what am I doing in the work that I do? What role does it have in society? And what can I do to further the causes of the revolution? And I think this is not unique to cultural workers, but definitely for myself, like as at the time I was working at an institution as a curator, it's something that, you know, a conversation I had with my colleagues a lot, and also with myself, like, what is the purpose of working here now? And how can I repurpose that to make it more useful for the revolution? So I think that actually, because of these kinds of questions that were raised at the time and how they continue, you know, people have really reoriented the way that they work. I think before speaking about myself more personally, like I want to say that in Hong Kong at this moment, there's never been more public spaces of exhibitions and art than there ever was in history. And I think that I feel confident in saying that without even running the numbers, because right now a lot of museums have opened. So I worked at Tycoon Contemporary, and that was a museum that opened in 2018 to the public. So there was that relatively mid to large size institution, non-collecting. Hong Kong Museum Art was under construction for a very long time. They've reopened with a new building and bigger program. M Plus Museum, which is a huge kind of collection-based museum that's been discussed for many, many years, has finally opened. And other spaces remain open. You know, you have Parasite, you have One A Space. Videotage still runs programs sometimes. You had this influx of commercial galleries from blue chip galleries like Zwirner or White Cube to also like still large scale, but mid-tier galleries like Lim and Maupin. I think, and I'm like wondering if they had a space there. I think so. And Ben Brown and all these guys. So you had all these commercial galleries as well. And some of the blue chip galleries are starting to move away from Hong Kong, like the really big ones. But that being said, like there's also this huge kind of wave of young people opening spaces now. And this is definitely a reaction to the evacuation of public spaces in Hong Kong. So right now there's, you know, the rule about like you cannot gather with more than four people. Like essentially there's no more public space to speak from. Mm-hmm. And because of that, in reaction to that, there's a lot of people who are like pooling money together to rent private spaces to have what would normally have been a public forum, but with a safer group, right? So you don't have like, you know, you don't have people. Like everyone's sort of pre-screened, like loosely, so you have to be sort of invited to go to these spaces. But the idea is to keep it safe, that there are no kind of like people snitching on you to the government and stuff like that, because there's also been a rise of this. Like people reporting on people for not adhering to the national security law. And this very much can be applied to the arts, and it has been applied to the arts. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, like actually what's happening with curatorial practice or in terms of artistic spaces in Hong Kong is on one hand very dire, but on the other hand also very exciting. I think that a lot of these spaces that are being opened up are by people younger than myself. They're people who may or may not have been old enough to participate in the Occupy Central mobilizations of the Umbrella Revolution in 2014. Many of those people who didn't participate because they were very young regretted that and came out in droves in 2019, despite what their parents said. And they have a very different orientation towards like what it means to have an art space, what it means to do art, that I think is actually very exciting.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you say that, that it's definitely that generational shifts are happening like almost mid-generation, right? Because in terms of age and in terms of time, the difference between somebody that would have been active in 2014 versus somebody who's active and an activist now is not that much. And historically, that would have been considered to be two separate generations. But I do remember in 2019 in Hong Kong, we were seeing children standing up against the government and really speaking against what they perceive to be very real oppressions, and children also that I think in many other contexts would be considered to occupy a certain space of privilege that might not necessarily have been exposed, right, to these oppressions directly or indirectly. Like it wasn't their business at that time, but they made it their business and they really stepped forward to kind of protect their future. And I'm also really curious about what you're saying about civic space and how civic space is becoming more and more privatized. Here in Kenya, we're having a lot of similar conversations because our last public civic space has just been, I guess, appropriated, and it's the Uhuru Park, which is downtown. It's one of the only free spaces in which people could gather, or people could hang out, or what in Kenya we call loitering. Like it's not appropriate here to just kind of be like hanging out in the street. So it's just been fenced off, and there's going to be a gate charge, and it's stimulating a lot of conversations around like where else people can gather, or more so conversations around like how spaces then come to be classed to a certain extent, right? Because there's certain people that can gather in certain spaces based on what the premium is, right? Some of us can go to a bar, or some of us can go to a church, and these spaces don't necessarily overlap because there is a charge to enter, there is a premium to enter, there is a buy-in to access these different types of spaces. So it's interesting that this is happening in a different way in Hong Kong. And I really wonder in that respect, because I think Hong Kong and Nairobi are like equally expensive cities, and maybe Hong Kong more than Nairobi. So how does this happen in a space where real estate is at a premium and so fraught and so contested, that there has to be a certain degree of materiality attached to living, dwelling, gathering, moving? What kind of spaces are these, and how are they accessible?
I think a lot of these kinds of art spaces that have come up they vary in size. Some are actually quite sizable and often involve like people making money elsewhere, like outside of the arts, and then somehow pooling it together to share. Maybe someone lives there, you know. It actually does remind me a lot about, the situation is actually quite different, but there are some similarities about the rise of collective spaces in Indonesia after the fall of the Suharto regime and the fall of New Order in 98. You know, on one hand, it's spurred by this desire to do something civic. On the other hand, it's also to do with kind of a lack of financial resources that you do share. Like a lot of them are shared living spaces. You know, so I think that in Hong Kong, like actually people are hacking it together in this way. There's also kind of, the real estate varies depending on the neighborhood. So there's also spaces like very far out and stuff like that too. Mm-hmm. But I think that what that also really does mirror is this idea that the movement was in every neighborhood, that it was a way to decentralize the kind of physical manifestation of power that you normally see with protests, is that they will often, you know, take a route through historic parks and end up at the government building. And this was the route that Hong Kong protests used to take. That began at Victoria Park, and it, like, you gather there, and then you walk, and then it ends up at the Legislative Council. But in the course of the protest, due to the shuttering, like the closing down of subways during protests and stuff like that, that people started to do these things everywhere. And I think that a lot of these, like the building of these art spaces all over Hong Kong, is also mirroring that. It's like, why do we have to be in the neighborhood where everyone is? Like, we're going to do something for our neighborhood. So this kind of sense of the civic is very strong, like in lack of any functional democratic structure. You know, it's a way to continue the ethics of the movement, despite its kind of criminalization.
Mm. And that's interesting that then you find workarounds in architecture, because I think we discussed briefly in Dakar, there were a lot of like public spaces in which we were gathering in, and there were a lot of like seeming spaces that really seemed, you know, it's a block of concrete and we can all just sit down, a group of 15 people, and have a chat for 2 hours, and nobody's concerned, nobody's agitated, nobody calls the authorities, which would never happen in Kenya. Like, this is completely, you know, in different contexts, you would be differently surveilled. But then I think after a while, we learned that like part of the Sangorian plan was that these neighborhoods were built with like specific spaces of gathering, but how you enter them and how you come out of them creates a bottleneck so that only so many people can enter and exit at the same time. And then strategically, like none of these spaces actually will ever lead you to the city center or will give you direct access to the presidential palace. So almost like an architectural blockade that is built into the structure, but then is so endearing and is charming in many ways and is narrated, you know, comes to be narrated in ways that that are so complementary of the authorities and of the system that people don't realize how they're being controlled or how the limits that are being put on them. I know in the next phase of your practice, you are trying to think more, I think you said, trying to think more about architecture and space. So might you be ready?
Yeah, you asked me earlier about like this, like kind of moving back to Asia, but after this 2-year sort of stint in Europe, although I have still been traveling when I'm here. Yeah. So I think, you know, I never really, I guess, developing new interests, right, in the last kind of few years. A friend of mine and I are starting a project which will begin with research and results, you know, very banally into probably a series of exhibitions and programs, like no crazy format. It's sort of tentatively called, though I do love the name and want to keep it, The First Bank Under the Sky. So like here we're actually looking at, our time frame is 1997. And so 1997, but the Asian financial crisis. So around 1997, when you say that in Hong Kong, of course, everyone thinks, I mean, even globally, about the Hong Kong handover from Hong Kong, from the British back to the Chinese. Mm-hmm. But the 97 financial crisis was like a huge event that was in a way overshadowed by this highly publicized event that was in Hong Kong. There was like 5,000 journalists who flew to Hong Kong for the handover. They built a convention center for it. Margaret Thatcher tripped on the red carpet. It was like sensational. Whole thing. But at the same time, you know, other than the Asian financial crisis, there was also a lot of political fallout and that was happening at this time period, and sometimes in relationship to the financial crisis. Like presidents were deposed, people were removed because of the financial crisis, but also things like, you know, the fall of the New Order regime in Suharto in Indonesia. Mm. And so when we look at the Asian financial crisis from 1997, it begins with Thailand. So the Thai currency basically drops and it's in total free fall because there's not enough foreign currency in the country. So a lot of these kinds of like financial crises have to do with how much foreign currency there is, usually American dollars, like the gold standard to stabilize the home currency. So once that started falling, though, like next falls Indonesia and Malaysia and like, you know, the Philippines and South Korea. And so the places that were most affected are, you know, maybe an economist would say different, but from my understanding of it is Indonesia, Thailand, and South Korea. Hong Kong sort of, and Singapore, they saved themselves in different ways. I mean, Hong Kong saved themselves by creating this kind of like algorithm to maintain a certain level of exchange. But at the time, you know, a lot of things were happening and this kind of financial crisis like dramatically changed everyone's position in the world. And so this is the time frame which we're looking at, but what we're also very interested in is how the transformation of banking architecture over time has mirrored the transformation of currency. So in the beginning, you have, especially, you know, a lot of the banks in the region were colonial banks. So The first banks in South Korea were Japanese colonial banks. The first banks in kind of Hong Kong, like brick and mortar style, we're British. But that being said, you can also say that actually banking as a system is like very, very old in the region. So, you know, like kind of Chinese banking as a thing of empire, like way predates colonialism, mm-hmm. actually. So there's that. I mean, I'm not here to advocate and resurrect the story that the Chinese invented, you know, our financial system. This is not a project about that. But we are interested in kind of more the contemporary era about how you have these like brick and mortar buildings and then they turn into these glassy buildings. And now they're kind of like, they were, no, turned into mirror buildings. And now they're like these like glassy buildings, and how this kind of transformation also mirrors the abstraction of money from like the kind of gold standard to this kind of like exchange to this mm-hmm. Even cryptocurrency. But in that sense, like we're looking at artists who kind of are growing up in this kind of time frame. We're also interested in numismatic museums and kind of from a very curatorial standpoint, how money bank museums tell their own national narrative. So like there's a whole genre of museums that are bank museums of like banks making museums about their own stuff. Often they have currency collections, but sometimes they have like, often they also have like these complex and very tightly wrought displays about their origin story. Mm. So I'm kind of, you know, going to be spending more time in these countries to look at these things and also kind of look at artists who are two groups, like one's kind of in their 30s now because they grew up in the shadow, but the other were people who were already active in 97 who made work about this. And of that, there are already quite numerous.
Yeah, thank you for...
It's very nerdy. It's a bit different from my other projects.
And yeah, so what do you think has given you the, I suppose the, like what, yeah, you say it's different from your other projects. What makes a project urgent for you? Like what has piqued this interest? And I know we've all like gone into the pandemic and come out knitting, but you came out and wanted to talk about financial systems. So, I suppose the question is like, what in this new age is motivating your practice? So what are the things that have come to be of interest to you as you move around and as you've been based in Amsterdam, but thinking now about like circulating back to Asia to a certain extent, what are the new agencies and what are the new priorities? And what motivates them?
I think I've always been interested in kind of inter-Asian conversations, yeah. But also in ways that are not necessarily about enumerating identitarian or cultural differences, but more about systems that actually align people that people are a part of. Mm-hmm. So I think like one of my previous projects that was in its own way can be interpreted as about the kind of Hong Kong and Chinese diaspora, like took the pageant, the beauty pageant as its kind of foundation in which to discuss like everybody's kind of particular situation. So I think that in that sense, this project does feel a bit more different. It feels a bit more kind of serious. It feels a bit more cold in certain ways when we talk about money and banks and museums. I don't think that the end result would be that just because of my and my collaborative sensibilities and material and exhibitionary sensibilities. But I think that it still is very much interested in that way of thinking, which is about, you know, like how are people connected quite literally through infrastructure as opposed to culturally connected or aesthetically connected, if that makes sense.
Yes. I think this is a good opportunity to mention that if you Google Hera Chan, now that you've spoken about the beauty pageant, the first person that comes up is Beauty Queen. but I'm really interested in this idea of, because you made a distinction between like Chinese banking systems or pre-Japanese colonial, pre-British colonial banking systems and banking systems that exist currently versus like what we're kind of moving into as new financial crises, but also new currencies emerge. And I was speaking to an artist the other day about, because we speak a lot in Kenya about the ways in which artists are materially disadvantaged and that they don't have access to funding and that it's not possible here to apply for a grant and get money to progress a project. So then it leads to like a certain other kind of production, right? Where artists are very much prioritizing what kind of work that they can sell, unless the research that takes 3 or 4 years or production that takes 3 or 4 years that is not necessarily commercially viable. And banking, the banking system here, the indigenous banking systems here, is something that really comes up a lot in those conversations, because these systems are robust and they are ways of building wealth that conventional banks or Western style banks could never give most people, the majority of the population, access to. So we have table banking where these little old ladies get together once a month and like, you know, everybody will have tea and somebody will bring cake and whatever. But at the end of the day, then they decide that we want to give a certain amount of money to Hera's project that she's doing next month. And this has really become a way of building wealth and keeping money circulating. And the question that we were asking ourselves or each other was like, how can these systems be replicated in art spaces and for art practices? Like, what kind of institutions can exist kind of mimicking or contrasting financial systems that already exist in society? And I wonder, because you talked to us as well about cryptocurrency, and of course there's big conversations around NFTs more than there used to be, and blockchain and all of that stuff is really becoming a lot more central to conversations that we have with each other, especially across like cultural regimes. So I wonder, and you talked to us as well about collective action in Indonesia specifically. So yeah, I wonder to what extent like these different ideas overlap for you, and to what extent they advise the kinds of communities that you invite to work with you, or like you are invited to work with. Yeah, who are you speaking to about these things? I suppose is the question.
I mean, right now, I think what we're seeing in South Korea is a huge governmental investment into contemporary art infrastructure. I think that there is this kind of like self-narrative on the part of the government that is talking about, you know, it actually is centered on the 97 financial crisis, because, you know, Korea, it was in a military dictatorship for so long, suffering, and then there's like the colonial kind of takeover by the occupation by the Japanese. And then in 97, they had to really beg the IMF for money. Like, they really had to like ask and plead for that bailout, you know, and the shame of that. And so now that it's more than recovered from that, you know, with the corporations in Korea and also other forms of industry, there's this sense of like, we must now, you know, like show them what we've got. I think what's also interesting is that, of course, Korea is like clearly a first world nation, you know, and has been for some time. But there is sometimes like some generations in Korea have this narrative that they still think about Korean finances as if it was the time of the dictatorship, which is just, you know, it's like false consciousness or something. I mean, like, I shouldn't use that term, but it's so not true, right? Like, it's a very wealthy country that has very much first world infrastructure.
Yeah, what? I suppose it's a little bit of trauma, though, right? Like a bit of a, how do you say, like a scarcity mentality, where you're unable to let go of being scared around money.
Yeah. I mean, perhaps, like, I don't, you know what that's like or kind of delve into that psychology so much, but in a sense, like right now there's a lot of, anyway, so there's a lot of kind of like investment into the arts in Korea. And it's sort of something that's happened to other cities before. I think at one point in Hong Kong, actually very recently in Hong Kong, there was also this kind of sense of like, we're going to have Art Basel Hong Kong, which drove a lot of, you know, these like blue chip galleries to move here. In Korea, you saw this year the introduction of Free Seoul. And also thinking about, you know, like what that means for a city. I mean, in a sense, like, of course, like the kind of relationship between finance and financialization in artists is something that people have talked about a lot in many ways. And there's a lot of people who have done it so incredibly. I think that in that sense, though, like, I was more interested maybe in the exhibitionary form and how that is able to denaturalize how these banking systems came to be. Mm. So in a way, like, that's kind of at the root of it. Because I think that in a sense, like, maybe work on that or kind of a criticality about the role of finance and city investment into the arts can be done very effectively through writing and through talking. But, you know, for myself, like, as a curator working with things and stuff and artists and artworks, you know, what is the best way to do that? You know, that's also effective and furthers curatorial practice.
Mm. That's a big question. And so, yeah, what are your movements in the next couple of months?
I mean, it doesn't have to be. I feel like it doesn't have to, like, further it a lot. It's just to keep in mind.
No, I mean, in a literal sense, because we did start the conversation thinking about, like, being diasporic. And I feel like a lot of the condition of being diasporic, especially, you see, I'm in the process of moving to Kigali from Nairobi, and I lived previously mm-hmm. in Dakar. I think that's where we met. But, like, thinking a lot about, like, being diasporic while also being at home, right? These places are home to me, and I think a lot of places in Asia are home to you, but you are also, like, not necessarily of those places, or you come to those places with different languages and different impulses and different instincts, different food, like, so many differences, despite a fundamental rooting and a fundamental welcome. Like, I think we're both fortunate enough to come from cultures that are relatively open and welcoming, and generous in that respect. So, yeah, as you think about your own mobility, and your own, I suppose, access in many respects, what are you moving towards? Like, what are the things that you are seeking out in leaving Amsterdam, or in making Amsterdam less of a central place in your practice and in your life?
I know, because I feel like this question of, like, even when we leave something, we're always moving towards something, is also quite hard to answer. Because I think in many ways, like, I will be spending more time in Thailand and Indonesia, maybe in Taiwan. And I think that those are places that are exciting to me and interesting. And they're also kind of filled with people where we kind of are part of the same nexus of conversation, you know, down to the very nerdy things that people who are not part of it may not be very interested in. And that kind of knowledge and work that I was doing in Hong Kong, this is a way for me to continue that. So I think in a very direct way, like, that answers that question. I think that, you know, like, in a way, I never came towards Amsterdam. Like, maybe that is a bit of a cop-out, but I was doing this program here and there was not so much thought that went into it. And I think that when I'm here, and not just in Amsterdam, but kind of, like, around Western Europe, there's so many interesting people and practitioners and things that are going on. But yet I still feel that I'm not ready to start fresh in that sense. To really, you know, be emotionally engaged in the civic here, I find challenging.
It's interesting that you say that, because you were involved in a whole political movement last year.
That was me trying.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because you very much approached it as a curatorial project, in some ways, or, like, when you were first articulating it was an extension of the project that you were doing as your final project at the Apple, and it turned into to many other things. But yeah, tell us a little bit about working in Dutch politics.
It was a little bit like the reverse. I think that because what was the prompt was that I was doing the DAPL program, and then we were five in the program that year, and at the end of the year the idea was that we'd have to make a show. And that every person, every curator in the program would choose an artist they would work with all year, and then to make a commission, and that would be, so that was the prompt. And the show would be comprised of these five new commissions. But, you know, when we first got to Amsterdam, it was, like, under a very harsh lockdown. We were, you know, I had just left the situation in Hong Kong. That was the kind of decline of the revolution. We couldn't really meet that many people in person because it was COVID. And then it was, like, kind of being asked to, like, marry someone without knowing You know what I mean? Like working with somebody all year long, like even if they're an amazing artist, like this is also about chemistry. It's also about like what I as a curator can give back to this person. Like maybe I cannot add anything to their practice, but about this mutual complicity that you kind of need time to develop. So I think that that was a bit of a concern. And so I think in that sense too, when I was here and I thought to myself like, oh, I probably might have to move here. I thought that I would, you know, like I can be involved in the civic anywhere and I would do that. And so that in that sense, I ended up working with an artist who was running to be in parliament. He was Quincy Gario was the runner up to Sylvana Simone, who's the head of the Bijeen political party in the Netherlands, which is the first political party running for parliament in Europe that is founded by and led by a Black woman. And I say that because actually a lot of their politics has to do with anti-racism, anti-colonialism, anti-capitalism as well. And their platform was comprised of a lot of people who never worked in politics in this way before, you know, this kind of electoral politics, where we're very engaged in politics from a social justice level, from community organizing, from social work. So the whole kind of party other than Sylvana was like comprised of these people, and Quincy is no exception to that. He's an artist, but at the same time as being an artist, he had led a successful campaign against blackface in the Netherlands in I want to say 2013, or it spanned 2011 to 2013, something like that. That was called Zwart Piet is Racism. Zwart Piet being the kind of caricature of the black chimney sweep who's supposed to be a figure of Santa, that and where all these like white people wear blackface for Christmas in the Netherlands every year. So he had led this very successful campaign against that, and then was also part of this political party, and then was a like kind of internally elected to be the second runner, the running mate to Sylvana. So in a sense, like it was a curatorial project, but I was like very serious about trying to help him get a seat in parliament. I thought it would be very interesting, like what would that be like, you know, to have somebody in a coalition-based parliament like him, the way that he speaks, the kind of ability to deal with polemics, his practice as an artist. But for that, we basically made a television show. We made a 4-part political talk show that was in Dutch, that was closed captioned and aired on television in the Netherlands, but also actually in the still occupied Dutch Caribbean on public television. And so the idea of doing that was because the platform is about being anti-colonial or decolonial. that, you know, the people who actually live in the Dutch Caribbean are never spoken to directly. And it's also not just in the Dutch Caribbean, but outside the urban centers like Rotterdam, Amsterdam and Den Haag, the people that this party is supposed to be speaking to do not really feel addressed. I mean, this is also like kind of made worse by the situation of COVID and the pandemic and the kind of like lockdown. But in a way, like the television show was about that. And also the whole show was like, I produced this show and the whole show was comprised of artists who were writing, who were performing, who were interviewing people, who are like doing the filming and the lighting. But there are all these artists who are not necessarily fitting in into the kind of like Dutch structure of funding and exhibition cycles, but were rather people who are artists who are very active in society. So in a sense, like I kind of did this and got very involved in this political party as a way to continue the kind of civic work that I was doing in Hong Kong and to also explore the possibilities of doing it differently in a different political system. Have you ever done something? I mean, you produce a lot of moving image work.
I do, and I started producing moving images as a way to work more by myself. So probably like a completely opposite ethic to yours. But no, it was for me. It was always about like how to kind of shift the burden of labor and shift the burden of like access from the artist to myself. And the timeline is a place where I found I could kind of gather images and gather voices without actually asking anybody to do any kind of work for free. And given the context that I just described, of course, like, we don't really have that much funding to do that many things here. And in many respects, there isn't even the culture, the cultural expectation that cultural workers will get paid for their labor. This is something that you're supposed to do because apparently it's a vocation, or, you know, it's a duty that kind of gets sent down from heaven, that somehow your rent, you know, the conversation that you should have with your landlord is that, no, I work for culture, and therefore I don't have rent. I don't know. But no, yeah, it's always been very different for me. And one of the reasons I'm moving to Kigali actually is to kind of try and shift my material conditions such that I can afford to make invitations to actual humans as opposed to humans in the archive, who are important to me, but don't have the same needs and don't have the same priorities, but also don't talk back in the same way. And Kigali is a place where I feel like I can afford to mobilize people in different ways. So yeah, it's all this to say, it's been my practice has been vacant of human interaction for a good few years, and I'm trying to kind of remedy that. I'm trying to make some corrections. Yeah, I think it's interesting what you ended up doing in Amsterdam, given quite a quick entry, right? Quite a speedy landing, because I know, like, culturally, the Apple is not the place where you get the best orientation of Dutch culture, or it's like it's not a place that's easy to situate within the context of Amsterdam. At least it wasn't while I was there. It was very much like separate from the city. And I think that has been a lot of the criticism of the program, that unless you have somebody from the city in the program, then the priorities of Amsterdam as a place don't really come up so much. I wonder if you can, just to conclude maybe, you can tell us a little bit, because I think most of what you and I have shared in our time together, which hasn't been all that much time, but we've been fortunate to meet in many different cities across the world. Can you tell me about, like, the place and the importance of food to your practice? Because I know that is, we always gather around food, and thinking more about community, thinking about civic space, thinking about spaces that are open, spaces that don't necessarily rely on certain languages or certain conditions to access. Food spaces really do become a place where you can kind of centralize a certain kind of ideology without creating an expectation amongst artists who don't necessarily have the resources to give to a practice, that they are still able to give some kind of, yeah, to have some kind of input, or to gather, to feel safe. And I suppose in Hong Kong, this is like a huge question, but also in many different spaces. Like, if people are eating, then they're less likely to be surveilled, they're less likely to be harassed. It makes this kind of visibility, this hyper-visibility that occurs around the rituals and the ceremonies of eating, kind of give you access to us and other kind of conversation that might be dangerous to have out in the open or in public in the same way.
I guess, you know, of course food is a part of my life and in its way is part of my practice, but I have to say it's not something I think about very consciously, you know, in the sense that there's artists who really work on that, on food politics, but also on like kind of artistic gatherings that are centered on food. Like, I have to say, like, I do not, you know, in respect of those people's practices, I would not say that food is a part of my practice in that sense. But I think in terms of it being a part of my life, you know, I think of course, the role of hosting people or inviting people, I think that, you know, in Amsterdam, there's more of an opportunity to cook for people than there is in Hong Kong. I did do it in Hong Kong, but my flat was kind of small and I had like one plug-in electric stovetop, so it'd be more limited. Sorry, I don't feel like I'm speaking exactly to what you're asking, but
no worries. To be honest, like, it was almost like an impulsive question, because I am moving to a place with historically quite, and I say this with, I say this reluctantly, but I'm quite confident in my position and in my opinion, I'm moving to a place with quite bad food.
and it's, why are you sure?
because I, there have been some cultural interruptions in the region and in Rwanda, but then also historically, food was okay. From what I gathered, this is what I'm told. In Rwanda, only people of lower classes actually ate food. Upper classes drank milk and ate meat occasionally, and they didn't move enough that they actually required that much nourishment. So it was, yeah, so there was like a weird classing around eating. And so the only people that ate potatoes and peas and rice and like all the food that are part of a staple diet in any context were farmers, were people that worked the lands. And these were almost like people that lived in conditions of indentured servitude or serfdom. So there's like a weird classing around food that makes it so that only certain people will acknowledge or articulate that food is important to them. And therefore, I found it like quite difficult to gather people or to like convince people to assemble, because for me, it's such an obvious thing. Like, if you would like somebody to sit with you for 2 hours, then you should feed them.
You've been to the Netherlands, you know what that's like.
Well, in the Netherlands, I remember going to a museum and being given like, what is that milk? The sour milk that they have. And this for me was the strangest thing ever. I did go to a museum once and this is what they had to give us. So yeah, I'll just a place that is like uncritical around how to create like linkages in civic space and linkages in artistic spaces that make that kind of like flatten the space or flatten the hierarchies or homogenize the space so that we're able to start a conversation from a place of like equity is kind of strange to me, and to not have the food as a tool or as a point of access, I think is like a peculiar challenge that I never thought that I would have. So I have been asking a lot of people, like, what do you eat and where do you eat it? And how do you convince people to eat the things that you're eating?
That's so interesting. I don't know, because I think that obviously in Asia, food is a really like people, it's like people are like eating food as they're talking about food, as there's like a television program about other food in the restaurant, you know? So it's like, obviously it is a big deal. Like, I mean, it's true. I mean, it's not very conscious, but I guess when I'm there, I do talk about food a lot, but it's not necessarily like conscious. Like, I have friends who I consider to be like actual foodies or people who are actually in F&B, who are actual chefs, who of course it's their job. They are talking about it all the time, but I do realize that when I'm there, we're like at one place being like, that other place also has this, you know, but I don't know. Like, I guess it's hard because in the arts, you know, you're asking so much from people without very much kind of repayment, and that feeding them seems to be the least that you can do. But yeah. I'm sorry. I don't know.
Don't be sorry. Cool. I think we can more or less wrap it up, unless there was anything urgent that you wanted to add. Are there any glaring gaps? I've tried to be like as general as possible.
I'm okay. Yeah.
Okay. So, well,
no glaring gaps.
Thank you for taking the time to have this conversation with me, Hera. And all the best in your moves, in your travels, in your stays. And I hope to see you soon somewhere.
Yeah, I'll come and eat that bad food with you.
Please do.
Even
please
do. Bad, we'll still gather around it.
I mean, I think definitely we can figure out, there are good staples, right? Good produce, I think, is always like a good basis. And I'm very grateful that there's always an Asian supermarket. Like, no matter where you go, there is a Chinese auntie who has set up a supermarket, and the sesame oil and soy sauce. So like, we have good beginnings. So I look forward to seeing you there. And thank you. Talk soon.
Thank you for having me.